Stein proceeded to the back room of the shrine, where the bodies were kept. It was down a short stairway, its walls set into the earth. He touched tinder to a candle and carefully descended the broad stairs. It was cold, and slow-melting ice dripped to the flagstone floor. Strong-smelling herbal possets hung from the beams, so the nostrils of visitors would not be offended. On raised biers lay the suspiciously dead of Altdorf, or at least the suspiciously dead the Emperor's court cared about. Here was a well-dressed young blood, his arm ending in a ragged stump, his throat torn out by some beast. Here was a little boy, his face flushed unnaturally red, his belly opened. Lowenstein stopped by the child, seized by a desire to place his hand on the apparently fevered brow, to find it hot or cool. He passed on, glancing at each in turn. Death by violence, death by illness, death by causes unknown. All death was here. The priests of Moor had placed amulets of the raven around the necks of all their charges, to signify the flight of the spirit. To the cult of Moor, remains were just clay. Bodies were revered for the sake of the living. The spirit was in the hands of the gods. Finally, Lowenstein came to the beer he was looking for. The dead woman was out of place in such a wealthy shrine. In her drab and patched gown, she looked more the type to be left in the streets to rot than to be pored over by the coroners and troubled by the concern of Crown Prince Oswald. All deaths among such people were suspicious, and yet few attracted the attention of the priests of Moor. All the other corpses here were from the moneyed classes. This woman had clearly been poor. Her throat had been raggedly cut, and the instrument lay on the ice beside the body. It was the dove of Shalya, blasphemously used in suicide. Lowenstein touched the open wound and found it cold and wet. He brushed the lank, greying hair from the haggard face. The woman might have been pretty once, but that would have been long before her death. As a young man, Lowenstein had seen Erzbet dance. It was in noon, in a travelling fair in the Grand Square. The woman had performed an exhausting solo, combining the high balletic techniques of the Nuln opera with the wild, primitive displays of the forest-dwelling nomads. He had been aroused by the performance, by the tanned legs that kicked up her skirts, and by the dark eyes that caught the firelight. She hadn't paid him any notice. That had been the night Bruder Wiesehole, king of the city's thieves and murderers, was killed. The next day the fair was gone, and the criminals of Nuln were without a ruler. Erzbet had been good. 25 gold crowns was her price. It had never varied, whether her intended was a mighty lord or a humble beadle. He had heard that, poor fool, she always insisted her clients debate ethics with her and justify the removal from the world of those they wished to be rid of. And here she was, Moor's meat at last. Her dead would be waiting for her, Bruder Wiesehole and the numberless others. He hoped she remembered her ethical discussions now and could justify each of her assassinations. He put down his candle by the corpse's head and prepared to take what he had come for. If he were to plunder the other beers, he would doubtless find rings, coins, necklaces, stout boots, silver buttons, golden buckles. But Erzbet had no goods to lose, had nothing Lowenstein's patron could possibly want. Except her heart. Lowenstein took the small knives, honed to a razor's edge, from their oilcloth, and tested the one he chose against the ball of his thumb. It stung as it sliced with the merest touch. And her eyes. Four. Genevieve took off her tinted glasses and looked up at the fortress of Drachenfels. It seemed different now, smaller. It was a pleasant spring day, and the ride up from the village was almost easy. The last time she had been this way, they had avoided the road. It was littered with the bones of those who had thought they could just walk up to the castle and knock on the door, and scaled the precipitous cliffs. There were other abandoned castles in the grey mountains, and they were no more imposing, no more haunted, than this one. There were none of the traditional signs of an evil place. Birds sang, the local vegetation flourished, milk went unsoured, animals were not mysteriously agitated. Even with her heightened awareness, Genevieve could sense nothing. It was as if the great enchanter had never been. Of course, Oswald's men had prepared the way. Henrik Crayley had sent out a squadron of cleaners, cooks, carpenters and servants to make the place ready for occupation. There had been some initial reluctance among the villagers, who had lived all their lives in the shadow of Drachenfels, to hire on with the company, but the Crown Prince's gold had overcome many objections. The lad who saw her to her horse after she dismounted must have been born well after the death of Drachenfels. The young of the region were reluctant to believe the stories told by their parents and grandparents, and some of the old were impressed enough by the ballads of Oswald and Genevieve to conquer their aversion to the ruin and take positions with Detlef's troop. The genius was in good spirits as he rode at the head of his gypsy caravan of actors, musicians and showpeople. He was a good conversationalist and eager to talk with Genevieve. They had been through the minutiae of Oswald's quest, of course, but the dramatist was also interested in the rest of her long life and was skilled at drawing out incidents she hadn't spoken of for centuries. The breadth of his learning was impressive, and she found him well informed about the great men and women of earlier eras. She had known Taradash, had seen his plays during their original runs, and cheered Detlef greatly with her opinion that the great dramatist was less skilled as an actor and director than as a writer. A regional touring company today could better the original Altdorf productions of Taradash's masterpieces without breaking a sweat, she opined.
Quite, yes, exactly, he agreed.
It was a performance in itself, moving the company from the von Königswald Palace in Altdorf to the remote mountain fastness, and they had been on the road for some weeks. But the journey flew by, with stopovers at the best inns and leisurely evenings with the cast discussing their roles and practising their sword fights. By comparison, the original journey had been long, uncomfortable and fraught with danger. Genevieve felt nothing as she passed the sites of battles long since won. She had made brief pilgrimages to the graves of Conradin, though there had only been bones to bury, and Heinroth, and found the markers Oswald had put up gone. There were no spirits lingering in the forests. Even the bandits had been cleared out years ago by the local militia. Despite it all, Genevieve found it difficult to be in company with Laszlo Lohenstein, the actor cast as Drachenfels. What she had seen of his performance was frighteningly good, and although he seemed off stage to be an ordinary conscientious craftsman, merely happy to be thrown a meaty role, she couldn't forget the impression he made when he pulled on the mask and tried to radiate evil. Even his voice took on the timbre she remembered, and his demonic laughter, somehow amplified by a device inside his mask, was bone-chilling. Rudi Wegner was with the caravan, Manesh the dwarf, and Anton Veit too. Veit was old, lean and ill. He avoided her, just as he had avoided her the first time. Rudi was also in poor health, she assumed, with his great girth weighing heavy on his heart and his great thirst similarly straining his liver and lights. Genevieve gathered he had suffered a loss recently and approached him about it, but he hadn't been eager to talk of Erzbet. That had been a long time ago. It had been a difficult subject to bring up, for Genevieve still recalled the first sign of the dancer-assassin's madness, her unprovoked attack. Otherwise, Rudy was still prone to boasting and garrulousness. He regaled the company with fancifully embroidered accounts of his exploits as a bandit in these very woods, confident that all who might contradict him, save Genevieve, were dead and in their graves. Only Manesh, the lack of arm notwithstanding, was much as he had been. Dwarves are more long-lived than humans. Genevieve understood that her one-time comrade had become something of a ladies' man since his injury forced him to abandon his life of wandering adventure. He was rumoured to have made several conquests among the girls of the chorus, and to be chasing the amorous record set by Kerith, the fragile little costume master, whose ways with the opposite sex were legendary. There was another dwarf in the company, Varga Bruegel, with whom Menesh was always arguing. Detlef told her that Bruegel wasn't a true dwarf, but human-born, and that he hated to be taken for one. Menesh was always thinking of cruel jests at Bruegel's expense, and Detlef, who held his assistant in high regard, had several times turned uncharacteristically severe and threatened to throw out the one-armed swordsman along the way. It wasn't the same trip, though, and Oswald wasn't with them. He would have to join the company later, at the head of the second caravan, which would bring the audience to the play. Detlef was good company, and there was a spark between them she could not deny. But he was not Oswald, regardless of the role he was to take in the play. Then again, Genevieve knew she was not Lily Nissen. The star travelled in her own luxurious caravan, which was driven by a handsome black-skinned mute from the Southlands, who acted as her personal servant and bodyguard. By his scars, Genevieve recognised him as essentially the woman's slave. The vampire had been presented to the actress, and neither party wished to further the acquaintance. Genevieve saw Lily's face as if it were a crawl with worms, and the actress pointedly refused to touch the undead woman's outstretched hand. Detlef, too, obviously had little time for Lily, but excused her on the grounds that, for all her foolishness and temperament, she could indeed be a goddess on stage.
She had the ability to make audiences love her, even if they would, singly or in twos and threes, find her less appealing than the average monster of the night she's probably possessed.
The accidents that had plagued the production in Altdorf abated, perhaps because of the presence of several of Henrik Crayley's pikemen. One inn along the way had been reluctant to accommodate the players, the owner having had bad experience in the past with the theatrical profession, but Crayley's men had quietly convinced him to change his ways. The only peculiar incident had taken place in a village at the foot of the Grey Mountains, where the caravan had been booked to stay overnight at a well-reputed traveller's rest stop. Detlef had been sampling the excellent food on offer and quizzing Genevieve about the Bretonnia of her childhood, asking particularly about the still-remembered great minstrels of the day and the precise qualities of their voices. Bruegel had come to their table in some state, accompanied by the owner of the hostelry.
"How many are we?" Bruegel asked. "In the caravan, I mean. Coaches, carts, wagons."
25, I think. No, I was forgetting Lily's boudoir on wheels. 26. What's the matter? Have we lost someone?"
"No," said the hostelier, apologetically. "Quite the reverse. You have one too many."
Detlef was taken aback.
"You've obviously miscounted."
"No. The Crown Prince's messenger specified 26 vehicles, and so I set aside space in the yard for that number. The space is filled, and there is one carriage left over."
"It's Lily's," said Bruegel.
"It would be," replied Detlef.
"And she's not happy about leaving it in the road."
"She wouldn't be."
The hostelier seemed unduly upset, until Genevieve realised he must have recently been shouted at by Lily Nissen. The famous beauty could be a mad gorgon at times. Detlef continued with his meal, complimenting the hostelier on his lamb chops in wine sauce. The man was from Bretonnia, and justly proud of his fare.
"The thing I can't understand, Detlef," said Bruegel, is that we've counted the caravan twice over. No matter where we start, we get the same number.
27?
No, 26. But there are still 27 places filled in the yard.
Detlef laughed. This is silly. You must just have arranged the wagons wrongly, taken up too much room.
You know what Crayley's ostlers are like. The wagons are as evenly spaced as old Maximilian's toy soldiers on a board.
Well, haul one of the scenery wagons into the road to make room for the human flytrap and have a drink.
The next day, at the off, Detlef and Bruegel counted the wagons as they trundled up towards the mountain road.
There, my friend, 26.
And our own wagon, Detlef, 27.
It had been a puzzle, but certainly paled when set beside Detlef's experience at the von Königswald Palace. It was hard to take seriously an extra wagon as an omen of evil. But the next night, Kaczynski, the scene shifter, still hobbling on his broken ankle, came up to complain.
I thought you wanted me to bring up the rear of the caravan.
I do, Kaczynski. You've the heaviest, slowest wagon. It's the combination of your head and the scenery that keeps it back. You always have to catch up an hour at the end of the day.
Then who's that behind me?
Detlef and Bruegel looked at each other and said in unison,
The 27th wagon.
And who's that?
Who knows?
They were camped in the open that night, the wagons together in groups. Four groups of six with three left over. 27. Detlef and Bruegel independently counted the wagons again and came up with only 26. But there were still four groups of six with three left over.
Detlef, concluded Bruegel, there's an extra wagon with us. We can't see all the time.
Detlef spat into the fire. Genevieve had nothing to add.
So, who is travelling with us?
Detlef hadn't talked much that evening, and Genevieve hadn't been able to draw him out. He had had a conference with Crayley's men and had them stand guard until dawn. When everyone else was asleep, Genevieve had counted the wagons. 26. She had an assignation with the youth playing Conradin that night and fed well. He looked white and dazed the next morning and avoided her for a while, so perhaps she had lost some of her control and taken too much. But the journey was over now. She looked around for Detlef, but he was busy with Bruegel and the architect, arguing over sketches. They could only see the castle as a giant stage set to be exploited for the maximum impact. Guglielmo, the Tyrian business manager, was off with the local Burgermeister, going over a list of provisions ordered and paid for. Genevieve put her glasses on again and saw better through the tint. The rest of the company were going merrily in through the great front gates, looking for their quarters, relieved to be off the road. Lily Nissen swept past with her little retinue, slave, dresser, astrologer, face-paint advisor, and went into the castle like a queen making a call on the lesser nobility. Genevieve stood on the road, hesitating. Looking behind her, she saw who else hesitated. Rudy, Veit, Manesh. They each stood alone, looking at the fortress, remembering. 5. The first night in the fortress, Rudy threw a party and invited everyone. There would have been a party anyway to mark the end of the journey, but Detlef Seok was kind enough to let Rudy throw it. Of course, Crown Prince Oswald had provided the food and wine, not to mention the fortress itself, but Rudy was there to bring the party to life. The last weeks, since Oswald found him in the Black Bat, had been good for Rudy. He hadn't been drinking less, but what he was drinking was of a better quality. He'd been telling the old stories again, with his usual improvements. But now there was a marked difference in the interest of his audiences. Detlef had listened attentively to his accounts of the original quest to Drachenfels, and the theatre people encouraged him to recall his other exploits. Rudy had always liked theatre people. Erzbet had been with her gypsy circus when they first met. He and his band had passed themselves off as strolling players on many occasions. Now, at his party, the company were enjoying the best theatrical story. He was remembering the time when, shortly after holding up a party of noblemen in the Drakvald forest, he had been forced to stage a performance for his erstwhile victims in order to convince them that his band were indeed showpeople rather than bandits. In his retelling, he claimed that the Lord Hjalmar Poldzig had recognised him straight away, but still insisted on the performance to humiliate Rudy. Surrounded by the Lord's militiamen, Rudy's bandits had improvised a tragedy about a bandit king and his dancing queen, and at the close of the play, Poldzig had been so moved that he decreed that Rudy should be rewarded and allowed to go free under the Lord's own protection. Detlef roared with laughter as Rudy told his story, impersonating the wily lord and the brash young man he had been. Deep inside his drink-besotted brain, Rudy remembered the real lord and the five good men he had strangled with bowstrings when he caught up with the bandits. He remembered the lord's jailer, hardly more than a boy, and the way he had screamed as Rudy battered him to death against the stones of the prison before making an escape through the castle's stinking drains. Sobbing and befouled, the bandit king had crept away in shame like an animal of the forest. Those had been days of blood and filth and desperation. The more he spoke of the days of plunder and glory and adventure, the more Rudy came to know that this was the real truth of the matter. What had happened didn't matter any longer. Erzbet was dead. Poldzig was dead. The boy was dead. His brains paced on the floor. The times were dead. But the stories lived. Detlef understood that, with his histories and his dramas, and Oswald too, with his play that would pass all their names down to future generations. Rudy, the dirty murderer. Rudy, who howled in grief and fear as he smashed in the skull of an innocent child, would be forgotten. Rudy the bandit king, Rudy the stalwart ally of brave Oswald, would be remembered as long as there were stages to dress and actors to walk upon them. Reinhard Jessner, the chubby young player cast as Rudy, called for another story. Rudy called for another pot of gin. The fires burned low, and the stories ran out. Eventually, Rudy slumped insensible. He could see the others, Detlef laughing, the vampire Genevieve as pretty as she had ever been, Veit haggard and silent, Bruegel arranging for more wine, but couldn't move himself from his spot by the fire. His belly weighed him down like an anchor. His limbs felt as if he were shackled to four cannonballs, and his back, his never set properly, never right again back, pained him as it had done for a quarter century, sending messages of agony up his spine. Detlef proposed a toast to Rudolf Wegner, King of Banditti, and everyone drank. Rudy belched, the turnip taste filling his mouth, and everyone laughed. Felix Huberman, the master of the company's music, signed to a few of his players, and instruments were produced. Detlef himself took the shrill Rauschpfeifer, Huberman the portative organ, and others the shawms, dulcian, fiddles, lute, kirtle, cowhorn, cornet, and gamba. The ensemble played and the singers sang, untrained voices joining with the trained. The old songs, The Miller of Middenheim, Mamidia's Doleful Lads, Gilead the Elf King, The Lament of Carrick Vaughan, The Goatherd of Apuccini, Come Ye Home to Baibali, Estalian Mariner, The Reich is Wide, A Bandit Bold, this over and over, To Hunt the Manticore, Sigmar's Silver Hammer, The Pirate Prince of Sartosa. Then the older songs, the near-forgotten songs. Manesh croaked an incomprehensible dwarfish ballad of great length, and six women burst into tears at its conclusion. Huberman played an elven melody rarely heard by humans, let alone played by one, and made everyone wonder whether his ears weren't just a trifle too pointed and his eyes on the large side. After some prompting from Detlef, Genevieve sang the songs of her youth. Songs long dead except in her memory. Rudy found himself weeping with her as she sang of cities fallen, battles lost and lovers sundered. Britonia has always had a reputation for luxuriating in melancholia. Trickles of red ran down the vampire's lovely face, and she was unable to continue. There are precious few Britonian tales with happy endings. Then the fires were piled high again, and the musicians played for dancing. Rudy was unable to stand up, much less dance, but he watched the others at their pleasure. Genevieve capered solemnly with Detlef, a courtly affair with many bowings and curtsies. But the music grew wilder and dresses flew higher. Jesna took up with Ilona Horvathi, the dancer cast as Erzbet, and swung her around in the air so her skirts brushed perilously close to the fire. Rudy could have been watching his younger self. Ilona was a spirited, athletic dancer, and she could perform acrobatic tricks, the like of which Rudy had never seen. Jesna, who had taken Rudy into his confidence, assured him that Ilona's imagination and physical stamina were not confined to the vertical brand of dancing. But she missed something of the grace, of the abandon, of the seriousness of the original. He had talked to her, and she was a cheerful girl, pleased to give pleasure. But there was none of Erzbet's passion. Ilona had never taken a life, had never spared a life. She had not lived at the edge of experience the way Erzbet had. And Ilona Horvathi wouldn't end her days in self-murder on the road from a madhouse. A hand fell on his shoulder. It was Weitz.
It's over, Rudy. We're over.
The bounty hunter was drunk, and his unshaven face was like a sagging skull. But he was right.
Yes, over. But we were here before, eh? Us old men, you and I, and the dwarf and the leech girl. We were here when these play actors were in their cribs. We fought as they'll never have to fight.
Veit trailed off, the light in his eyes going out, and keeled over, sideways. Like all of them, he'd come out of Castle Drachenfels a different man than he had been outside the gates. Rudy regretted that he had not seen the bounty hunter in 25 years. They had shared so much. They should have been lifelong friends. The fortress should have brought them together. Especially those hours, injured in the dark, waiting for Oswald's return, knowing that the prince would die, and that things with claws and teeth would be coming for them. The weight of wine shifted inside Rudy, and he desperately felt the need to piss. He shifted upright and staggered away from Veit, his head spinning like a child's top. Jesna loomed before him, saying something he couldn't make out. The actor clapped him on the back and sent him stumbling. The musicians were still playing. Ilona was dancing alone now. He made it into the next room, away from the light and the clamour. After he had relieved himself in a cold fireplace, he turned to make his way back to his place by the fire, to his friends. She was in the doorway, between him and the party. He recognised her slim-hipped figure and long dark hair at once. She wore her dancing dress, slit to the thigh on one side, and immodestly tight in the bodice.
"Rudy,"
she said to him. And it was 25, 30 years ago, the days of plunder and glory and adventure.
"Rudy,"
she extended an arm to him, her bracelets jingling. He felt the weights falling away from him and stood up straight. There was no pain in his back now.
"Rudy."
Her voice was soft yet urgent, inviting yet dangerous. He lurched towards her, but she stepped aside into the dark. She went to a door, and he blundered after her, pushing through it. They were in a corridor. Rudy was sure this was where they had fought the living gargoyles, but Oswald's men had cleaned it up, put fresh candles in the sconces, laid down carpeting for the visiting dignitaries. Erzbet led him on into the heart of Drachenfels. In the chamber of the poison feast, a man waited for him. At first, because of the mask, he thought it was the actor, Lowenstein. It wasn't. The man looked up from the table at him. His eyes shone through the slits of his mask. He had cutlery laid out before him, as for a meal. But there were no forks and spoons, only knives. The man picked up a knife. It shone like a white flame in his hand. Rudy, cold inside, tried to push himself away, back through the door. But Erzbet stood before it, blocking his escape. He could see her better now. Her low-cut bodice disclosed the great red gash, like a crushed mouth sideways, in her breast. She threw her head back, and her hair fell away from her face. He could see that she had no eyes. 6. Lily Nissen's favoured method of communicating with her director-writer co-star was through Nebenzahl, her astrologer. If she was unhappy with a line of dialogue, or the performance of some lesser light of the stage, or the food served in her private rooms, or the noise made by the party she pointedly hadn't attended, or by the way the sun persisted on rising in the east every single solitary morning, she dispatched Nebenzahl to whine at Detlef. Detlef was beginning to feel quite sorry for the poor charlatan, who was finding his easy berth so unexpectedly rocky. It was the man's own fault, Detlef supposed, for not foreseeing in the cards, stars or entrails what a monster his employer would turn out to be. The company were in the Great Hall of Drachenfels, which had been converted into a theatre. Lily chose to make her entrance over the stage. As usual, she assumed there was no business connected with the play more important than her whim of the moment, and had herself borne in by her chair-carrying giant in the middle of a rehearsal. It was an early scene, where Oswald, in the palace at Altdorf, is visited by the projected spirit of the great enchanter. They debate, in verse, the conflict to come, and the major themes of the play are foreshadowed. Detlef was having Varga Bruegel read his own lines so he could concentrate on Lowenstein's performance and the lighting effect that would make him seem insubstantial. With the mask, the thin actor seemed a different creature altogether. Genevieve, who was sitting in on the rehearsal, was shuddering, probably reminded nastily of the real Drachenfels, and Detlef took that to be a tribute to Lowenstein's skills. When he could get perspective on the play, Detlef realised he was in danger of being overshadowed by the villain and resolved to make his own performance the more masterful. He didn't mind. While he took pride in his acting, he disdained those stars, of whom Lily was most definitely one, who surround themselves with the most wooden, untalented supporting actors available in order to make themselves seem better. During the journey to the fortress, Lily had tried to persuade him through Nebenzahl to cast some of her favourite walking statues in the other female roles in Drachenfels, and he had kicked the astrologer off his wagon. Having written, directed and conceived the play, Detlef felt he could afford to let others shine in it. He planned on taking last billing as an actor in the programme, allowing the weight of his name to be felt as the creator of the piece rather than as one of its interpreters. Lowenstein, as Drachenfels, was towering over Bruegel, vowing that his reign of evil would continue long after the puny prince's whited bones lay in forgotten dust, when Lily made her unscheduled entrance, trailing her entourage. The black giant carried an oversized armchair without complaint. Lily sat primly in it, like a child being carried by a fond parent. Her crippled dresser limped a few paces behind, bearing a basket of sweetmeats and fruit, part of the star's special diet, and a few other functionaries whose exact purpose Detlef had never divined were also along to lend weight to their mistress's current gripe. Nebenzahl strode up to Detlef, visibly embarrassed, but nerving himself to make the complaint. Lily snarled imperiously, like a mountain cat with delusions of leonine grandeur, and fixed her flaming eyes on him. He knew it was going to be a bad one. If she chose to air the problem in front of the entire company, it was bound to involve a major row. The other actors on stage and in the audience shifted nervously, expecting a firestorm of Holocaust proportions. The foppish astrologer stuck out his fist and opened his fingers. The teeth were in his hand.
"Lily Nissen has no need of these, sir."
He threw them on the ground. Kerith had carved them especially, working away at scraps of boar's tusk ivory. The wardrobe man was in the hall now, angry at the treatment of his work, but keeping quiet. He obviously had no wish to go back to being a cobbler, let alone a convict, and had correctly gauged the extent of Lily Nissen's vindictiveness and influence.
"So, it's a toothless hag you think I am now, Detlef Seok," shrieked Lily, her face reddening.
Her slave put her down, and she flew out of her chair, raging across the stage, knocking Bruegel and Lowenstein out of the way. Detlef imagined angry eyes peering out from Lowenstein's mask. Lily wasn't winning herself any more admirers this morning, and of course it was such a stupid thing to bitch about.
"Lily, it's no reflection upon your own teeth that I want you to wear these. It's the part you play."
Lily rose to the bait.
"The part I play? Ah, yes, the part I play. And who cast me in such a role? Who created such a disgusting travesty of womankind with me in mind? Eh?"
Detlef wondered if Lily had forgotten that Genevieve was with them. He suspected not. It was plain the women, vampire and vamp, didn't care for each other.
"Never in my career have I been asked to play such a part. Were it not for the involvement of my dear friend Prince Oswald, who personally implored me to step in and fill out your petty little cast, I should have rent the manuscript to bits and flung it back into the gutter where it belongs. I've played empresses, courtesans, goddesses. Now you want me to play a dead leech."
Being reasonable wasn't going to help, Detlef knew, but it was the only tactic he could think of.
"Lily, our play is a history. You play a vampire because Genevieve is a vampire. After all, she lived this story. You only have to recreate it."
"Pah! And is the drama invariably subject to history? Do you mean to tell me that you have changed nothing for the sake of emphasis to show yourself to the best advantage?"
There were mutterings at the back of the hall now. Nebenzahl was looking distinctly sheepish, patting down his ridiculous wig, self-conscious now he found himself on stage facing an unknown audience beyond the footlights.
"Of course, but..."
Lily was unstoppable. Her bosom heaved as she drew breath and continued,
"For an instance, are you not somewhat too old and fat to play my good friend, the future elector of Earthland, as he was when but a boy?"
"Lily, Oswald himself asked me to play him in this drama. Given the choice, I'd probably want, and no reflection upon you, Laszlo, to play Drachenfels."
The star flounced towards the lights and came so far forwards her face was in shadow. The house lights came up.
"Well, if you've rewritten Oswald as an ageing and overweight child prodigy, then you can rewrite Genevieve as something more suited to my personality."
"And what, pray, might that be?"
"An elf."
No one laughed. Detlef looked at Genevieve. Her face was unreadable. Lily's nostrils flared and unflared. Nebenzahl coughed to break the silence. Elven Lily might once have been, but she inclined rather to the voluptuous these days. Her last husband had referred to her as having the breasts of a pigeon, the lungs of a Bansidha, the morals of an alleycat, and a brain like Black Mountain cheese. Lowenstein laid a hand on Lily's shoulder and spun her round to face him. He was a full foot taller than her, and his built-up Drachenfels boots brought him up on a level with her silent giant. Unused to such treatment, she raised a hand to slap the impudent actor, but he caught her wrist and started whispering to her in a low, urgent, scary voice. Her colour faded, and she looked quite afraid. Nobody else said anything. Detlef realised his mouth was hanging open in astonishment and shut it. When Lowenstein had finished his speech, Lily blustered an apology, an unheard-of thing for her, and backed out, dragging her slave, her minions and astrologer with her. Nebenzahl looked appalled as he was yanked out of the great hall. After a moment, there was a spontaneous round of applause. Lowenstein took a bow, and the rehearsal continued. 7. Maximilian stood to attention while the general was speaking. It was late, but the general had awoken him with secret orders. The general told him he must get out of bed, get dressed, and go down to the battlefield, where the fate of the empire was to be decided. After the emperor, the general was the most important military leader in the land, and Maximilian always wanted to impress him with his obedience, resourcefulness, and courage. The general was the man Maximilian would like to be, would have liked to have been. When the orders were finished and understood, Maximilian saluted and put the general into his top pocket. This was a serious business. These were times of grave danger. Only Maximilian stood between civilization and anarchy, and he was determined to do his best or die. The palace was quiet at this time of night. Quieter in the days, too, now that Oswald's theatre friends had gone. Maximilian missed them a little. There had been one dancer who'd been sweet on him and liked to join in with his battles, making suggestions and asking questions, even though Nurse disapproved of her. Nurse disapproved of a lot of things. In his slippers, Maximilian was almost silent as he proceeded through the corridors and down the stairs. His breath was short, and he was getting a stitch, but the general would want him to continue. He would not let the general down, no matter what. He thought he saw robed figures in the shadows of one passageway, but ignored them. Nothing could keep him from the fray now he was needed. The battle room was not locked. There were several armies on the table, goblins, dwarves, elves, and men, and in the centre was a castle, the objective. The imperial standard was flying from the great tower of the castle. The flag was tattered, but waved proud. The armies were clashing already. The room was filled with the tiny sounds of their weapons clanging together, their cannon popping. When they were hit, the soldiers screamed like shrilling insects. The tabletop battlefield was swarming with life. Miniature swords scraped paint from lead faces. The dead were melted in grey pools. Puffs of smoke rose. Battle trumpets sounded like echoes in Maximilian's head. The general had ordered him to hold the castle for the emperor. He needed a chair to step on before he could reach the table. He put his foot down on the battlefield, crushing a bridge to Stickwood, pushing a platoon of wood elf war dancers into the painted stream. He pulled himself up and stood like a giant on the table. He had to duck to avoid a chandelier as he stepped into the castle. The walls barely came to his ankles, but he was able to stand in the courtyard. The defenders of the castle cheered to have such a champion. Moonlight came in through the tall, thin windows. The night battle swept across the table, backwards and forwards. The armies had lost all direction and were turning upon themselves. Sometimes all four forces appeared to combine to launch a new onslaught on Maximilian's castle. Mostly, every single soldier seemed at war with every other. he detected the claws of chaos in this business. The felt of the hill was torn as charges fell back from the castle walls, and dark wood showed through the scratches. The general kept up Maximilian's morale as a wave of goblins clambered up the hill and breached the walls. Dwarf engineers pushed a war tower forwards. Cannonballs stung his shins. Still, he held the fort, at attention, saluting. The castle was in ruins now, and the armies were attacking him, trying to bring him down. The defence forces were sought out and slaughtered. Maximilian stood alone against the enemies. The wounds inflicted on his feet and ankles were flea bites. Bretonian soldiers poured fire over his slippers, but he stamped it out, and the fires spread back to their ranks. He laughed. The sons of Bretonia at war always were noted more for viciousness than valour. Then the battle wizards came forward and threw their worst spells at him. Frightful fiends swirled about his legs like fish, and he swatted them away with his hands. A three-headed creature with eyes and a maw in its belly flew for Maximilian's throat, and he caught it. It came apart like cobweb in his hand, and he wiped it away on his jacket. Spears stuck to his calves, and he felt dizzy to be at such a height above the ground. Goblins were scaling his trousers, hacking through his clothes and sinking hooks into flesh and bone. There were more fires. A ballista and several mortars were deployed. There were explosions all around him. His right knee went, and he was pulled down. Small roars of triumph went up, and his back was riddled with a million tiny shots. Knives, small as head lice, sawed at him. Spears like needles jabbed. He fell across the battlefield, crushing the remains of the castle, flattening the hill, murdering hundreds beneath him. He rolled onto his back, and the armies reached his face. They set off charges in his eyes, and he was blind. Berserkers set fire to his hair. Warrior wizards opened up channels to his brain. Pikemen attacked his neck. Fresh conjured demons burrowed beneath his skin, excreting their poisonous filth. The general told him he was doing well and that he must keep up the fight. In the dark, the Emperor Luitpold and all his court waited for him. Maximilian knew he would soon be permitted to leave the field of battle, to take his well-earned rest. There were medals and honours and eggs for him. He would receive his just rewards. The armies moved over him, laying waste to whatever they found. They captured the general and executed him. To the end, the man was a hero. His lead head rolled across Maximilian's chest and bounced lifeless onto the table. Tired and relieved, Maximilian sank into the darkness. The next morning, his nurse found him, lying dead among his beloved toy soldiers. Physicians were called for, but it was too late. The old elector's heart had finally given out. It was said that at least his death was sudden and easeful. The sad news was delivered to the new elector with his breakfast. Oswald von Königswald wept, but he was not surprised. 8. Genevieve was on the battlements, watching the sun go down, feeling her strength rising. There was a full moon, and the view was lightly shadowed. With her night sight, she saw wolves loping in the forests, and silent birds ascending to their mountain nests. There were lights burning in the village. She was stretching, tasting the night, wondering how she would drink this evening, when Heinrich Krayli found her.
"My lady," he began, "if I might beg a favour."
"Certainly. What do you wish?"
Krayli looked uncertain. This was not like Oswald's smooth and efficient cat's paw. His hand rested casually on his sword hilt in a manner that instantly disturbed Genevieve. During the long trip from the convent, she had gathered that not all his services to the von Königswalds involved simple message-bearing.
"Could you arrange to meet me in half an hour and bring Mr. Sierk with you, in the chamber of the poison feast?"
Genevieve raised an eyebrow. She had been avoiding that particular place above all. For her, the fortress held too many memories.
"It is a matter of some urgency. but I would appreciate it if you could raise it without alerting anyone. The Crown Prince has charged me with discretion." Puzzled, Genevieve agreed to the steward's terms and left for the Great Hall. She supposed the dead must have been taken from the table by now and given their proper burial. She would probably barely recognise the poison room. Thus far, she had encountered no ghosts, even in her imagination, at Drachenfels. No ghosts, just memories. Rehearsals had finished for the day, and the actors were being served in a makeshift canteen. Bruegel was haranguing the Bretonian cook about the lack of a certain spice in the stew, and the cook was defending the recipe handed down to him by his forefathers.
"Dwarfish bouffin, you have not lived until you have tasted casserole à la Boudreau."
Jesna and Ilona Horvathy were all over each other in a corner, petting as they joked with other members of the cast. Manesh was talking intently to Gesualdo, the actor playing him, and gesturing extravagantly with his one arm, while the other dwarf nodded. On the stage, Detlef and Lowenstein were stripped to the waist, toweling off the sweat they had worked up practising the duelling scenes.
"You've been giving me a fine dash about Laszlo. Where did you learn the sword?"
Without his mask and costume, Lowenstein was diminished, seeming rather dull.
"At noon, I took classes from Valancourt at the academy."
"I thought I recognised that vertical parry. Valancourt taught Oswald too. You'd be a formidable opponent."
"I hope so."
Detlef pulled on a jacket and buttoned it. Although plump, his muscles were well defined. Genevieve gathered that he too was skilled with the use of the sword. He would have to be, given his fondness for heroic roles.
"Detlef," she said, "could we have a word in private?"
Detlef looked to Lowenstein, who bowed and walked off.
"An odd fellow, that," Detlef said. "He's always surprising me. And yet, I get this feeling that there's something not all there about our friend Laszlo. Do you know what I mean?"
Genevieve did. To her heightened senses, Lowenstein registered as a complete vacuum, as if he were a walking shell waiting to be ensouled. Still, she had met many people like that. In an actor, it was hardly surprising. It did not really matter who Lowenstein was offstage.
"Well, what's up, elf lady? Do you want me to dismiss Lily and hire a human being for the role?"
"No, it's something mysterious."
He smiled.
"You intrigue me."
She smiled back, on the verge of flirting.
"Crayley wants to see you, us, in the poison room."
She caught his scent in the air and felt the pricking of the old thirst. She wondered how his blood would flow.
"I wish you wouldn't lick your lips like that, Genevieve."
She covered her mouth and giggled.
"I'm sorry."
He grinned. "The poison room, eh? Sounds lovely."
"You know the story?"
"Oh, yes. Children tortured, parents left to starve. Another one of the great enchanter's charming little jokes. He'd have made a good match for Mistress Nissen, don't you think? Imagine the fun they could have had exchanging recipes for the best use of babies. You have not lived until you have tasted enfant à la Boudreau. Lead on."
She took his arm, and they left the great hall. Detlef winked at Kereth, the wardrobe master, as they passed through the door. The little man laughed and rubbed his neck. Genevieve blushed. She could imagine the stories that would be told during rehearsals tomorrow. Oh well, after all these years, her reputation could hardly be more tarnished by an association with an actor. In the corridor, they continued to talk. Detlef was making a conscious effort to be charming, and she wasn't putting up too much resistance. Perhaps, if stories were to be told, she should make the effort to justify them.
How does it feel to have those teeth anyway? Aren't you forever cutting your lips? A witty reply came to mind, but then they entered the poison chamber and saw the looks on the faces of the people grouped around the table and the mess that lay on it. When Detlef had finished vomiting, Crayley told him who it was. 9. Detlef was relieved to learn that he wasn't the first to be sick. The body had been discovered by Nebenzahl, the astrologer, and the little parasite had puked his breakfast at once. Even though he spent the greater part of his professional life peering into the entrails of chickens and cats, the exposed insides of a human being caused him much distress. Detlef wondered if there was a way of divining the future through the examination of vomit. Apparently, Nebenzahl had been looking for some trinket misplaced by his mistress and opened the wrong door. He had a talent for awkwardness and, as everyone had noticed but Lily, absolutely no foresight. Detlef looked from face to face. Henrik Crayley was expressionless, a hard-faced man with a hard situation, intent on not giving anything of himself away. Genevieve seemed beyond caring, but she was not making jokes anymore. Besides, it would be difficult to tell if a vampire were shocked pale. Nebenzahl was still sobbing quietly, clinging to one of Crayley's halberdiers, occasionally scraping at the regurgitated matter on his brocaded waistcoat. Varga Bruegel, whom Detlef had insisted on summoning, looked as he always did when faced with yet another problem, as if every disaster in the world were intended personally against him. And Rudy Wegner did not look like much at all. His face was still there, but it hung loose like a soggy mask thrown over a skull. Detlef's first thought was that the old bandit had been flayed, but Crayley had already performed the distasteful task of closely examining the corpse and knew exactly what had been done to Rudy. The eyes are gone, you notice. Fished out with a dagger or small knife, I'd guess. An unsqueamish man could do the job with his fingers, but he'd best wear gloves. Detlef had the unpleasant feeling that Crayley was talking from experience. Electoral houses needed a servant or two with more loyalty than scruples. It was hard to associate open, upright Oswald with this lizard-hearted Iceman. But that's not what killed him. No. It looks like a wolf got at him, or a ravenous demon, something that attacked in a frenzy, devouring, tearing. Crayley smiled a one-sided smile. Yes, I thought that at first, too. But look here. He pointed into the body cavity, lifting a flap of skin from the ribcage. No bones are broken. The organs are untouched. That, in case you're interested, is what a drinking habit like Wegner's does to your liver. The organ was red, swollen, and covered with pustules. It was obviously rotted through, even to someone who didn't know what a healthy liver looked like. Detlef thought he was going to be sick again. Crayley poked at the wounds. Whoever did this did it calmly and with great skill. Genevieve spoke. What exactly was done?
My lady, all the fat has been neatly cut out of his body.
Crayley left the dead thing alone, and the group moved away from it by unspoken mutual consent. Detlef was outraged. Why would anyone want